This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And our topic this week is refactoring.
That might be something you know a little bit about.
Yeah, maybe a little. So first, some follow-up. Now, Xcode 6 Beta 3 has been released by Apple this week, I believe, since our last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to put a link in the show notes to the release notes for the Beta 3. Now, you're going to need to log in with an ADC account to see the release notes. I believe some things Apple has made such that they're completely public, so that you don't need any sort of login to see them.
Right.
That's not the case.
It's really confusing to me what's public and what isn't anymore, and what requires a free login or what requires a paid login. And
Right. Well, I think that this it requires a login, but I'm pretty sure that you can download it without needing to pay the money for it.
Right. Right.
That's what they're doing for this particular thing. Yeah. So yeah, you know, have a look. And there's a lot of stuff in it. But the thing that we're going to talk about, the thing that's most interesting to me, is the changes to live views.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I did my episode, oh, and you know what? I don't have a link to it handy. The What's New in Xcode 6 episode that I did, I guess, 2 weeks ago. Not 2 weeks
yeah,
ago.
Yeah, so that's
ago, two episodes ago.
94. All right.
Where, and as we have discussed, that is our first EdgeCases episode, which has exactly the same name as an Apple WWDC session, right?
So right.
That's a first for us in episode 94.
Are you planning on keeping that going?
Well, if we did, we would have a lot more episode titles to use.
I think it'd be great even if things didn't fit. Like, it might right. even be better if things didn't fit.
What's new in Interface Builder for a show about, you know,
CRDTs?
Yes. that would confuse some people. So they said in the release notes that views that opt in to Interface Builder live rendering are now supported from within your application and no longer require a framework, which we actually talked about specifically, that it was kind of a drag, that you needed to put a framework in there to make it all happen. So I had said, I think in our last episode, that I had a big fan sample project. I'll put a link in the show notes again to that, where I tried to do some things to make live rendering work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I downloaded Xcode 6 Beta 3, and I changed my framework, and I've pushed the changes in a branch.
Oh, great.
In that project, so you can try it yourself.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Now, would you put a guess as to whether you think it works if I take it out of the framework and put it into the app?
Well, I unfortunately read your tweets, so.
That's right. Damn it. Foiled by tweets once again. Oh, yes, it doesn't appear to work.
Yeah.
Actually, did I say that it didn't work, or did I just say, oh, yes, I asked if anybody had gotten it to work.
Which pretty much, yeah. Yeah. I don't want to say begs the question, because apparently everyone uses that wrong, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the law of big numbers. Everybody gets wrong. So it doesn't appear to work. It gives me an error, or gives me a warning, and the warning says, let's see, ignoring user-defined runtime attribute for key path, fan background color, on instance of UI view, hit an exception when attempting to, and here it's elided s dot 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 ue, probably set value, UI view, and then a pointer number set value for undefined key. This class is not key value coding compliant for the key fan background color. And so what they're doing here
is... I've been listening to you all night reading long exceptions.
Yeah, we're not going to do that.
But anyway.
The idea being that it thought that the object in the zib that was actually my big fan view subclass was UI view.
Yeah, so
and
that
so
sounds
it, it
like
got that wrong. It didn't figure that out. Now it's funny that it only got it wrong in certain ways, because the actual UI in the left hand side, which shows your properties, your runtime attributes, was showing up correctly. There were the color palette widgets for the two things that I had set up there. So it's part of Interface Builder works, but the other part does not.
Hmm.
Now, what's interesting also is that these warnings, you only get them when you open the storyboard. They're not build warnings. They don't show up when you build. So they don't show up in the report navigator either. They only show up in the issue navigator. And we have talked before about how Xcode doesn't really do this all that well, that the issue navigator, it only shows you a couple of lines. I think it's two lines at this point. It might have only been one before of your error or your warnings. And this is a giant warning, as you were just so poetically pointing out, that So it doesn't all show up there. And normally when I get a really long warning or error like this, I go to the report section to see the whole thing and see more details about it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't show up there because there's no action that it knows about. It doesn't list opening a storyboard as a report action.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just kind of screwed about that. So it seems like it's a bit weird. It's also a bit weird that they seem to elide a portion of the error. Even when you look at it in a tooltip, which is the way to see the whole thing, it seems like they ran out of characters. I don't know. Why would you run out of characters?
Have you actually tried like clicking on the issue and copying it to the clipboard?
I don't believe that works. Does that work from the issue navigator?
Let me quickly check. Yes, it does.
Okay, and then what do you see?
It looks like the full issue in this case I have some sort of issue, and it looks like, well, it actually has a dash at the end, which might indicate that maybe it didn't copy every single thing. Let me double check. No, this one actually includes the entire stack trace. That's very, very close.
Oh, really? The whole stack trace. That's cool.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, right? Because it's not a build warning. It's like a runtime warning because it's got the pointer value in there.
Right.
Because it is trying to run it. In any case, this is probably enough time to talk about that for this thing. But it does seem that it just doesn't quite work yet. And I'm a little surprised because this is a very simple example that they would say, well, hey, this works now when it doesn't work with something very simple. And I should probably file a bug. And I'll do that tonight. Maybe. I'll do that this weekend. Because it is, you know, if it doesn't work for this, then how many other things is it not going to work for? But at least it shows that they knew that this was a problem and that they're trying to fix it. So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so moving on to refactoring. So first I'm going to start with the definition of it. And for the definition, I'm going to go to Martin Fowler.
I was wondering if you'd invoke the Fowler.
So Martin Fowler didn't invent refactoring, but he wrote what many would consider the defining book about it, which is Refactoring, Improving the Design of Existing Code. And I had a copy of this. I don't have it anymore, but I do have the sample chapter. So I looked through a little bit at the beginning of it again. And he talks about the definition of it. And he says, refactoring is the process of changing a software system in such a way that it does not alter the external behavior of the code, yet improves its internal structure. It's a disciplined way to clean up code that minimizes the chances of introducing bugs. In essence, when you refactor, you are improving the design of the code after it has been written. Now, my own take on this from when I heard about what refactoring is that a fairly essential part of refactoring is that you're refactoring in order to do more to it, in order to prepare the code for further work that actually will change the behavior of it. But you want to do refactoring because you want to make it more ready for that, for those changes, for those further changes. And because if you didn't need to do those further changes, then you probably just leave it as is. So that's my take on it. I guess that's not officially part of the description of it.
I will say that refactoring is often abused as a term, that basically when people go to rewrite code, they'll call it refactoring.
Right, right. Well, so it's interesting, and this is one thing that I'm going to get to kind of next, is I've always just, I heard the description of it, I heard the title, the definition of it when I was first learning about it, but I never really thought that hard about what the word means. Mm-hmm. Like, why is it called refactoring?
Right.
Well, that's because factoring is one way of describing the design of your program. And so I looked that up in Wikipedia as well, and they said, for factoring, which is more specifically known as decomposition, and I'm just going to read from Wikipedia again because this is apparently what I'm going to do all tonight, refers to the process by which a complex problem or system is broken down into parts that are easier to conceive, understand, program, and maintain. That just sounds like design.
Yeah.
Is one loose way of describing that. So when you say refactoring...
Well, it's software design. It's architecture design. Yeah. It's not like Johnny Ive design.
Right.
Right.
Right. And so when you say refactoring, you're really also kind of saying redesigning your code.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where that comes from.
Okay.
So it's not just... Yes, as you said, people abuse the name of it. It's not just any change to the code base. It is changes that keep it working exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And... Yes,
I believe in Martin Fowler's book, and you might talk about this, that I believe he actually defines like two types of transformations, basically the inverse of each other, right?
I'm sure I read that originally in the book.
You already have this one sample chapter to work from now. But yes, often...
well, and a couple of hours of prep time as well. I'm not... You know,
yeah, right.
But
right.
yeah.
But yeah, a lot of his, you know, I'm actually kind of, I wouldn't say hostile to the refactoring book, but it left me cold. And but that said, I'm such a fan of like naming things, and Fowler does a great job of like naming so many things, giving names to things, and then also like saying you can change the software this way, but you also can do it the inversion way, and this is how you inverted that same thing. And I don't want to derail you too much, but go ahead.
Sure. I'm curious. Yeah, we'll see if we can sort of come back at this idea of leaving you code, because that's an interesting idea for me. But yeah, we'll see. So yes, he and I guess it's probably not just him. It's probably that he got this from the other people. And there are other names that were mentioned there before. I'm going to put a link to the Wikipedia article in there, which mentions the people who kind of originally came up with the concept of refactoring. Mm-hmm. So you can look at that if you're interested. But the operations, I get the sense when Fowler talks about them and when everyone else kind of talks about refactoring, is they tend to mostly be talking about these specific operations that you do. And when I was learning this, I tended to call them transformations.
Yeah, I think that's a better word.
Is that? I'm not sure if that's from the Fowler book or if that's from somewhere else, but it seems like Fowler on his website, and he actually owns refactoring.com. I guess that happens when you started this early enough that you got the .com of the thing that you want to talk about. He just seems to call them refactorings. Okay, refactoring is the term he uses for the operation. But I thought of them as transformations. I think that might also be a more computer science-y way of describing it as well. So he also has a list of sort of common refactorings, and that's refactoring.com/catalog, and I'll put a link in the show notes there as well. So there's a whole bunch of them there, and it seems like these are pretty much your standard things that you do. When you talk about refactoring, you're not talking about, again, any changes. You're talking about kind of these kinds of transformations that you can do. And so there's, I don't know, maybe 50 here, but a lot of them are just variations of other things. He's got a lot of extract types. So extract is one of the things. You take something out of where it is and you make it its own section. So so for Xcode, for example, it has extract method or function. So you take some code out of one method or function and you make it its own method or function. But he's also got, Fowler has got, you know, extract class, extract interface, extract method, extract module, blah, 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 all sorts of things. And then rename is another biggie. And it's interesting that Fowler only says rename method as his transformation name. But really, even he talks about everything. He talks about renaming classes, renaming a whole bunch of things. So just rename, I would think, would be a good way to describe that as well. And then there are ones that are a little more obscure, but also very useful. Like replace magic number with symbolic constant, which is really, you might not think of that as refactoring, right? Because that's just, that's a find replace, really. But it's also something that it's conceptually, it's, okay, it's, you're actually refactoring out of it because it's the same behavior, but it's also making it better. And then replace type code with polymorphism, which is also interesting to me because I've seen that everywhere. I've seen that a lot of infrastructures, a lot of architectures will say, well, here's your class, but then it can be one of these 200 types or, you know, whatever, not 200, but, you know, five types. And that always struck me as a code smell that you really, if you wanted to take full advantage of your OO language, you probably don't want to just have a simple number giving you that. But people use the numbers because it's more convenient. It means you can use the same type in a whole bunch of different places. So I would be interested actually in how far you can take a transformation with attempts to replace those things. So that's interesting to me, but I'm not going to say too much more about it today. Now, his book was, as far as I remember, mostly, if not entirely, talking about how to do these refactorings manually. What changes to make in your code base, how to think about it, such that you made this transformation, you implemented this transformation in your code in the safest way possible, in the most conceptually clean way possible. And so if you're interested in that, interested in how to do refactorings in your own code, and you're not really clear about how to do it, then, you know, you can go read the book. That's not going to be my focus today. Because when most people talk about refactoring, they don't associate it with regular programming, with regular typing. They instead usually associate it with automated refactoring in your IDE. So that's more about what I'm going to be talking about today. And there are a whole bunch of IDEs that you guys have all probably used at one point or another in your careers that do these things. Visual Studio has, as far as I remember, a fairly extensive list of transformations. Eclipse has a lot of transformations. The one that people are probably using more today is Apcode. Apcode gets a lot of respect a lot of kudos for having a lot of refactorings, a lot of transformations that it supports. And then, of course, there's Xcode. And so I guess I've mentioned this to you, Wolf. I've probably mentioned it to a lot of people. I'm not sure I've ever talked about it on the podcast. I have said on the podcast and elsewhere that I worked on Xcode at Apple, but I don't believe I've mentioned, and I actually put a little link, a post, I guess it was 2 years ago now, mm-hmm. Called caveat/manifesto, where I talked about how, what kind of line I was going to draw about what I would talk about since I did work on Xcode, and yet I wanted to talk about Xcode, mm-hmm. and yet I worked on Xcode. So how do you do that dance? And what I said there was, well, I won't talk about the stuff that I'm going to talk about Xcode 4 and not Xcode 3. I'm going to talk a little bit more about Xcode 3 here because it's just part of the topic. Mm-hmm. But I'm still going to do that kind of dance. I don't want to talk about too much of, Apple internals in ways that I think
you're not going to give us the class names of the two others.
Well, you can get that from some of the crash reports, actually.
Okay. I was going to go with class dump, but crash reports even better.
Now, when I mention this to people, because I mentioned this to people in person, the reactions I get are rather interesting. And I think one of the extreme on the one side is when they say things like, oh my God, Xcode refactoring sucks. and I'm actually thinking about it now. It's actually a little surprising that they would say that right to my face. But it brings up a bigger point, which is we're part of a fairly close-knit community. And so oftentimes when you talk about things, you know the people who worked on them, up to and including even Apple engineers who worked on things working on an Apple. And so I've seen that some people tend to be selective in their criticism. They'll criticize some things, but not the things that their friends worked on. And I mean, I criticize a lot of things. That's pretty much what I do on this thing. And yet on the other hand, you know, I worked on this feature at Apple, prominent Xcode feature, and I'm proud of my work. There, part of what I was able to do there. So does that mean that, you know, I don't want you to criticize refactoring because I was proud of it? How do I square that? And how I resolve that in my own head is to say yes. It's certainly a fair target for criticism. If I couldn't take it, I shouldn't be in public. I shouldn't be, you know, out on Twitter and on the podcast, even especially talking about it on a podcast. So I think it's a valid thing to say that, you know, a feature doesn't do what you want. It has bugs. It's various things that you are dissatisfied with about something. You can say those things without saying the work on it was entirely invalid. And that's always what I mean when I talk about Apple things, when I talk about third-party things. I've been critical in... Have I been critical? I don't remember exactly what I've said in the past already. I've mentioned some things about, you know, CocoaPods that I'm not a fan of. I think, you know, does that mean that all the people who work in CocoaPods, well, you know, I think they're all horrible people? No, I just, it's just the focus of what you're working on. And I also think that a lot of this has to do with working under constraints, which I have in my notes is Constance. Thanks, autocorrect. So an example of this would be Acorn, right? An image editor written by, you know, a friend of the show, Gus Mueller, who was actually on the show in episode 87.
Yeah. We'll put him as a... I'm pretty sure he doesn't listen to the show, but he's a friend of the show.
All right, great. Because it's, some people would probably say, well, Acorn doesn't have all the features of Photoshop, you know, therefore it's bad, or therefore I don't like it. And it's certainly, again, I think, you know, it's valid to say, well, it doesn't have the features that I want from Photoshop, therefore I'm not going to use Acorn, I'm going to use Photoshop instead. But what you probably wouldn't want to say is, well, that means that, you know, Gus has just done a bad job with this, because Gus is working under certain constraints that the people who work on Photoshop do not. Mm-hmm. They have a much larger team, he's just one person. And all those same constraints that you say, well, this is why Acorn doesn't do all the things that you want it to do, are also going to be true of the refactoring effort that I worked on. And that's part of, again, squaring that circle. You know, I was on a fairly small team, like Apple's teams are fairly small, limited amount of time in the sense of, you know, you didn't have 10 years to work on it, only had, you know, the release cycle for a particular Xcode release, a limited mandate, limited technology. There was no LLVM available at that point. So all of those things were constraints on what I could create with the people I was working with for that. And it's valid for someone else to say, well, you didn't make what we wanted to, but to still say that that's not good work. Well, no, it's good work for the constraints that you were under. And so that's what I...
I have to say that knowing the technology you had to work with, since you didn't have LLVM, I'm surprised refactoring works as well as it does on IF code. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Now, the other side of it, though, and the part that I feel, I also feel, is a valid criticism, and that I might even make sometimes, is that the follow-up about it is that there are a certain number of transformations in the Xcode, in the version of Xcode that had that refactoring introduced, that were not as many as most other IDEs have, and we have not added more to it since that time. And that's also valid, saying that you know, why weren't there more? I think that the way to have said how could Xcode possibly catch up when it's so far behind all these other ones, even at the time that it was released, would have been to say, keep working on it, keep adding to it. But that's something that they didn't do. So let's see. One of the things, and the last note about this that I wanted to mention is one idea that I had recently was that it's possible, and other people might have had as well, is this idea that maybe they're not putting the extra effort into it now because of Swift.
Right.
Because,
as a matter of fact, I took a Swift source file and tried to invoke refactoring on it.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't work at all.
It doesn't work. Yeah, but that's
it
not
throws
surprising.
Up a sheet. Yeah, throws up a sheet saying, can refactor a non-C based language in code?
Right.
Language code. Xcode can only refactor C and object to C code.
Right. So that would be, that's probably, well, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't there at that point. But one thing that's interesting to me is saying, well, Swift is the reason why it's been neglected. That can only be an excuse after a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
Because Swift, by their own public descriptions, was only started in 2010. And refactoring, it wasn't like refactoring got great updates up until 2010 and then stopped. No, they really didn't do anything with it since the original release, which was much earlier than that, 2007, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see what they do with it next. I think Swift, well, we'll talk a little bit more about Swift towards the end of it. So let's see, how do you make a refactoring system? Let's say you want to make, in an automated fashion. So let's talk about rename, because rename is probably one of the simpler ones, and also the ones that everybody uses.
That's the only one I use.
Yeah.
I use a lot.
So this, the first step that you would want to make, you want to do, and of course you do this in person too. You do this if you're going to make your own code. Just type in the changes. Is you want to determine what you're going to change. And what that means is you need the name of the thing that you're going to change, and you need its type. Now in Xcode, the way that this is figured out is you have to select a symbol in your source code file. And in that way, you're selecting both the name and the type from a particular place in the code. It could be the class declaration, for example, or the class definition, but it doesn't need to be. It can also be a usage of a class or usage of any type that you're using for what you are. If you were to select a comment, you would get an error saying you need to select a symbol in Xcode. So the next thing that you would probably think to try, if you're thinking, well, I'm going to go through all of the places that you could do this in, is can I do it from the symbol navigator? And if you were to try this right now, Wolf, you would find that, yes, it does work.
Hmm.
That if you select a symbol in the symbol navigator, and then you right-click on it, you get the same contextual menu that you would get if you selected
this,
that.
This is the first time I ever noticed that. Wow. Okay.
Right, sure. Now, there's a little bit of fiddliness in there in that the selection in the source code, you're selecting something in the source code when you select something in the navigator, because the navigator is a navigator, it's not its own thing. And if you change your selection in the source code file after you select the navigator and then right-click on the navigator, then it doesn't work quite right all the time. But, you know, it's fine. It's not how you're mostly going to use it. Mostly you're going to be selecting the thing in the navigator and then using it right away. Those are the only two places that I can think of in Xcode right now. In Xcode 3, there were more places? Because there was a different... Well, there was the class model. So I don't actually think that was ever hooked up. But, you know, that would have been another place that you could have done it. And if there were more symbolic UI-based things in Xcode, then presumably there would be more places where you could initiate this stuff from. But so that's the first bit. That's why you can't just do it from any particular place in the code, comments or other weird places, you know, text files, because you need the type as well. Now, you want to find all the occurrences where that type is being used in your code. And so if you were doing find replace, you would, you know, just do find replace through linear search through all the text in your in all your files, and you would find it that way. But that finds false positives, because that's not just finding the things that are of that particular type. That finds everything. Right. So if you have, and you know, that most of the time that's not a big deal. Most of the time you can do still do renaming from there. But it's sometimes you can't. Sometimes it would cause problems. So in terms of doing this automatically, in terms of doing this in a programmatic fashion, you generally need an index of some sort to make that work.
Right.
You need a way so that instead of doing a linear search through everything to make it happen, you can just look it up, a dictionary lookup rather than a array traversal.
I think an index might actually be a little bit humble. I mean, you kind of need to know a lot more about more than just the index, right? Like, you kind of need to know, like, the AST. Or like, maybe not to the extent of the AST, but you need to know, like, classes and methods and stuff like that.
Funny you should mention ASTs. The ASTs, I'm going to be talking about that a decent amount in the time we have left. So how do you get that information? Well, yes, you need the ASTs from your files. Mm-hmm. And the way I was going to describe it...
I guess we should abstract syntax trees is what AST stands for. Yeah.
Right,
so it's kind of it's basically the data structure behind the code you write.
Right, and we have talked about ASTs before. Let's see, what was the putting your scent on the code?
Okay,
episode 44, where we talked about abstract syntax trees versus concrete syntax trees.
Okay, we did. Yeah, you're right. We did reference it before. There you go.
We did mention them. Now let's see where I'm going to have to jump around a little bit here.
What I didn't mean to derail you.
Yeah, a bit, but that's fine.
So
what does that mean? It means, well, you're taking the stream of words and letters in your source code and turning it into something more structured so you can understand it better. So we'll get to the tree part in a second, but what does the abstract part of it mean? And I thought I knew. I thought I had a good grasp of why it's abstract versus concrete, but it turns out that when I look it up in Wikipedia and to try to refresh my memory, Wikipedia is fairly mushy about that.
Hmm.
They say that a syntax is abstract in not representing every detail appearing in the real syntax. So that means the concrete syntax trees have every detail of the real syntax, and that's what makes them different. And so when I looked up concrete syntax tree, and those are parse trees versus, what is the other one? Syntax trees versus parse trees. Parse trees are distinct from abstract syntax trees in that their structures and elements more concretely reflect the syntax of the input language. Mm. And again, that's really mushy. I would have hoped for a more definitive reason why they're different.
Maybe you can think of like things like white space.
Well, like whether they're really included? The difference? Is that really the only difference between the two of them? Is that white spaces in there? I think there's going to be more to it than that.
It might be. I actually don't know myself, but it might be.
Well, I've never used concrete syntax trees.
Yeah, I've always been AST guy. Yeah. Right.
So there are many things. So that's kind of what abstract means, although not really. So sorry. But then a tree. So a syntax is the structure of your code. What does a tree mean? The tree means that they're taking the structure of the code. They're taking what it does, what it represents, and changing it from, again, a stream to a tree. And so what happens is you take all of the pieces of your code and you form it into, and it's like diagramming a sentence, really.
Mm.
So every element of your code gets a node in the tree. And if the element of your code encases conceptually other pieces of the code, then those pieces become children of that parent node. Whereas if there's something sort of happening one right after the other, then they're siblings of it. And I'll give you examples of it, because that will make a lot more sense. So one of the enclosures is the class decoration, for example. So you have a node representing the class decoration for, and that has the name and, again, the type part of it. And again, we talk about types are important here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the children inside of it are going to be things like the property decorations and the method decorations that are inside of that. And so each of those is a node. And so a method decoration, that's also a parent node, because the children nodes of that are the parameter types that are inside that. And so again, the whole tree of those things. Another top-level node is the class definition is a node, parent node. Inside of that are all the method definitions. And so you have five method definitions, and each one of those is a child, the siblings inside of the class definition. But then inside of each method definition, this is where order gets to be important. Because here, each statement, I believe it's statement. It's either statement or expression, but I believe it's statement. Each statement of your code is then its own parent node. And inside of that enclosing statement node is, let's say, all the commands that are part of that statement, all of the references to the things that the commands operate on. So commands are like while or if or for, the basic building blocks of your language. Then there are the references to types, to objects, to instances. So if you say if I equals whatever, then the if part is one node, and then the reference to the I is another node, and the, in is another node, or whatever you're doing there.
Mm-hmm.
Operators are each their own node.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you say, equal, your assignment operator, then the children of the operator are the left and the right-hand sides of it. So it might seem a little odd when you're looking at the code. Well, but the left-hand side is before the operator, and the right-hand side is after the operator. And so shouldn't there be a stream of just three children nodes where the left-hand side, the operator, and the right-hand side are those? No, because you're putting in a tree because that's how it's that's the structure of it. That's how you mm-hmm. want to think of it. You want to think of right. it as the operator operates on things, so those are children of it. So that it gets a tree down the end of it, and so the order is often very important. And left hand, right hand side, the left hand side is going to be the first child, and the right hand side is going to be the second child. So that's important that they're in the right order. You wouldn't want them reversed, because then that's a different thing. You mm-hmm. wouldn't want the statements to be in the wrong order. Right. Because the statements, you have to do the statements in order. And yet other things, they're much less important. The order of the definition, method definition nodes inside of the class definition are much less important.
Right.
Than otherwise. In terms of refactoring, you also want to know where these things occur in the files. So you're going to want to know the offset in the file. You're going to want to know what file they're in, and then what offset they're in that file. Which is, it's the bare essential of what mm-hmm. you need to know. But as you talked about, there are other things that the ASCs don't include. They don't include comments.
Mm-hmm.
They don't include white space. I mean, there's no white space node in general that you put in there. They won't include like your indentation style. And this is where I was going to mention that putting your cent in the code. It doesn't include all of that information that you would need to rewrite that file exactly the way it is. And there's reasons for that. For one, the people who write parsers don't think those things are all that important to put in. For two, when you're writing a parser, you don't necessarily want to take the time to gather up all those things. That's memory, mm-hmm. and that's extra time running through them that you generally don't need for compilation. Mm-hmm. Because that's where all this stuff comes from. That's why we talk about LLVM. It's because when you're writing a parser, you're generally writing it for a compiler. You may be writing it for other things as well, but your primary client for that is the compiler. No. Okay, so Clang is generally the way that you want to do these sorts of things because it detaches the front end and the back end. So Clang, we want that. We want to detach front end and back end. If you have this, you should probably go see your doctor. But for Clang, it's a good thing. Because what happens is you get the parser takes the source code, takes the files. And thanks for that, by the way. And it makes these ASTs. The ASTs are the intermediate representation. And there's actually probably several different layers of intermediate representation, but let's stick with the ASTs for now. Because they include everything you need to compile your application with. And then the back end is the code generation part of it, the actual thing that builds up the binary of mm-hmm. your application for it. And so those two pieces, you need those two pieces. If you can separate them out and get the ASTs from the parser, from the compiler that way, you can then use those ASTs for a whole bunch of symbolic operations.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were saying, yes, for you'll generally get your index information from those ASTs. You can also use them for, for static analysis,
mm-hmm.
right? And they do that now for static analysis.
Yeah,
that's the client compiler. And very, very interesting and useful for that. But the thing is, that's a lot of information, and it's not listed in a way that is indexed directly. It's listed in a way such that you can use it to make your application or to analyze your code. But if you want to say, well, I want all the places where foo is, you can't just use the ASTs to get that information. You need an index on top of that. unless you want to be running through your ASTs, running through all of your ASTs every time you want to do any refactoring at all.
Mm.
So I would generally tend to say that you need some way to narrow it down.
I was just saying that the time complexity of basically recursively running through all your ASTs ends up just taking way too long, so you want kind of a top-level symbol table there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So exactly how you do that is kind of an implementation detail.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble, if you make a really detailed index, which has every type and every, you know, every little thing that's from the ASTs, then basically you've replicated the ASTs,
right.
Which point you have a problem of keeping them consistent and everything else. So, but the less information you have, then the more you actually have to keep going back to the ASTs to gather up the rest of the information. So that's a process. That's a balancing act for you to do that. But yes, it's the only reason the reason you need the index is to make it faster. You don't need if you do have the time to just go through the ASTs every time, then you can just go ahead and do that. Now, if you wanted to then go through and say, well, I'm going to rename, my class foo to class bar. The ASTs make it really simple because you can find all the types of class bar, the references to class bar, because as I said, there's a node for that and it's clearly labeled as such. You get all the information from the parser. And you're kind of done, right? That's really all you need. You need to actually say, well, find where that is in the source code and make the change in the source code. But you should pretty much be able to make that happen pretty well. Now, there are some things specific to Objective-C and C-based languages that make that more difficult. You need to also, for example, if you're changing the name of your class, you might also be changing the name of the .h and the .m files.
Sure.
You need to go ahead and do the imports. Now, you might think that would sort of automatically happen. But ASTs are, they're really simple.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any more information than you've already decided to put into them. So your import statements are also, I can't remember if they're actually nodes or not. I mean, they're compiler directives. So they are treated a little bit differently. And you will have to take care of that. If you say, well, I also want to change the name of it, you'll have to do that as an extra step on top of it. And what if, for example, you don't import the specific header there, you only import it another header that includes that header. Then you can't rely on saying a very simple step, hey, I'm only going to look for the import statements in the files that already have a reference to this thing.
Mm, good point.
They might not have it.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to go through every import in every file because there might be no references to the thing that actually holds the reference to that file. Anyway, it can get a little complicated.
Yeah,
to get all this stuff to work. But conceptually, it's not that hard. Methods are a little bit more interesting because you may, especially with Objective-C, you may be sending the message that has the same name as the method you want to change to an object which is not of your type.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, types of ID, where you don't know what it is.
Right.
And so then you may notice that Xcode says, gives you a warning, which says, hey, do you also want to change this place where we can't tell what the class is? But it might be your method.
Is it like based on @selector type stuff?
Well, so let's say I'm changing my method. Description,
class,
whatever.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
The description is a Apple method, but anyway, my description, whatever, and you want to change it to description.
Mm-hmm.
The invocation of the invocation of the method is a node in the abstract syntax tree, which has that name in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you know that it's an invocation of a method. Mm-hmm. You know that it has the name right, and so you know that that's where you want to change it. The thing that you're operating on is also a reference. It's a reference to the type.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do with it then is entirely up to your refactoring code. You could say, well, it's type ID, therefore I'm going to include it in my thing. Okay. You may also know, well, it's a invocation of a method of the same name on an unrelated class.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, where automated refactoring especially comes in handy, because you can say, oh, no, that's something else. I'm not going to include that. I know that that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, all these compiler folks tend to really like static typing.
Right.
Because if everything's ID, then everything's up in the air. That you can't know how that's being used.
Mm-hmm.
You can try to figure it out. So, for example, if the thing is of type ID, you can try going backwards from that and saying, well, how is that type getting set? Who sets that object? Mm-hmm. And so if you can keep moving backwards and say, well, it's set from these, you know, three methods call this method, which has this instance and usage of it. And then I can go through all those ASTs for those methods and find out where they get the variable that they send in as a parameter that's used over in this other place. And you can try to keep going back and back and back and keep trying to figure out from their types, well, what do we actually send to this? And that's pretty much what static analysis is, mm-hmm. is trying to do those things. What was interesting to me when I was working on this is how simple it is, in that oftentimes the logic to figure out what to do in these circumstances is extremely simple and extremely simplistic, because otherwise it's very hard to write, very hard to figure out. So when you say, well, you should be able to static analyze my entire program and figure out everywhere where this method is getting, you know, this parameter is getting set, that's really hard to do, and that's why they don't generally do it. And it's also the case with Objective-C. It's really very, very difficult to find all of the dynamic places that you do things with. So, for example, I think this might have been what you were getting at, perform selector.
Right.
You also, you know, if you're changing a method name, you probably want to try to change those places as well. But Objective-C is so dynamic that it makes it really difficult to figure those things out. You could probably do the thing where you say, in addition to finding the usages of this method directly, I will find all of the places where we invoke perform selector.
Right.
And perform selector with, you know, all the variants of it. Mm-hmm. And then look at where we're getting that selector from. So if you just, you know, the at selector, then that's something that's very easy to figure out. So, okay, mm-hmm. we figured out that's the thing. We'll change that there as well. What if you're using selector from string?
Right.
Or whatever it's called. Right?
Yeah. Whatever the method's called. All bits are off at that point.
Well, they aren't quite off, because if you say, well, you're using that, but you're using a static method.
Oh, sure. Good point.
Then you could figure that out as well. But then what if it isn't a static method? What if it's a string that's passed in from somewhere else? Well, again, you could try to go back further mm-hmm. and figure out where it's coming from, and if all those places that it's coming from are static strings. The example I was thinking of is, well, what if you load a string from a plist?
Right.
Right? Then you're, you know, then you just can't figure it out at all.
And technically, you could actually, I mean, so if the compilation time plist, yeah, you could actually even walk that. But I was thinking of like the F script example where it drops a sheet and say, what selector would you like to send? And you type in random string and, yeah, I'll send that for you. Yeah, so that type of dynamicism that obviously cannot be statically analyzed.
Can't be figured out.
Analyzed.
And then, so the question becomes, how far do you go to try to figure those things out? Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some point you've got to say, well, no, this is so unlikely that I'm just not going to try to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually running a little low on time.
I would say go long.
I'm getting closer to being done here.
Okay.
We don't
have you talking about refactoring very often, so I think it's worth going low long for it.
So the next bit, so we're trying to figure all this stuff out, and we talked about how complex it can get. Well, what happens when there are bugs in your implementation of this sort of thing? One of the things that was interesting to me thinking about when I was working on refactoring was the hierarchy of bugs. Wolf, what would you think is the most important kind of bug to fix, like parser crashers, non-compiling code?
I would think that anything that ends up mutating the code in a way that breaks it.
Well, yes, but there's actually a twist to that, which is doing it silently.
Sure.
Is the problem. Mm-hmm. Because if it changes your code in a way that breaks it but doesn't compile, that's not as bad as the bug where it changes your code and you have no indication that it's changing your code except from running the code and trying to figure it out.
Good point.
That's the worst thing. So that was actually the thing that we prioritized the most, silently screwing up your code.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, beyond that, where the rest of them crashes are important, obviously. You don't want to crash Xcode if you can help it. Non-compiling code is important, and of course it's embarrassing when you make a change and suddenly the thing doesn't compile.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not actually as bad as some of these others, because if it doesn't compile, then you know to go there and fix it yourself.
Right.
And figure it out. So, in terms of crashers, you've probably seen some crashers in the refactoring code in Xcode when you try to refactor something complicated and then Xcode all goes down.
I've only used renames, and that's been pretty much stellar for me. So.
Yeah, I think extract does it more, unfortunately.
Okay.
But the problem here is that your parsers are written in C++, You know, even Clang is written in C++. Mm-hmm. And the optimization that they're going for is generally to be fast. So they're not written to, well, I mean, they, you know, of course they try to be as robust as possible, but it's more important that they're fast than that they're robust in the face of unexpected situations. And of course they're dealing with pointers directly, which, you know, they don't want to, you know, Apple wants to get away from that, obviously. But, you know, they're doing a lot of, you know, they're not doing a lot of message passing where if you send something nil, then it's not, it's, you know, it doesn't crash your application. They're, you know, they're using C++ pointers to make all that stuff happen. And that's, you know, again, that's a fallout from using something which is primarily used for compilation. And that also is kind of interesting with parsers and with compilers that this happened more before, but it still happens now, where if you do something which the compiler doesn't understand, doesn't expect, the first thing that a compiler is going to do is it's going to bail out right then. It's going to say, well, this is something I don't expect here, therefore it's an error. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I know about the error is that I saw something I didn't understand right here. Mm-hmm. They're not going to try to understand, the parser itself is not going to try to understand that point, because it's about being fast and being correct.
Yep.
And so one of the things that's interesting that we've seen with Clang recently is that, especially with GCC, they didn't tend to do this, but with Clang, now they have all these things. They say, well, did you mean to do this other thing?
Right.
Instead of doing this thing.
Right.
And the reason they can, I believe, and I don't know this for a fact, but I believe what's going on is that they left the parser as is because they want the parser to be fast, but they kind of did a whole CSI thing. They said, okay, let's look at the crime scene and see what we can figure out after the fact. And then we'll show you something else. And I think that's a good sign for Clang that they have the time, that they have the ability to do that.
Is they invoke the very costly analysis phase after they hit some sort of parse error. They're basically able to rewind and enhance and look at environmental information that they normally wouldn't have, and maybe have to reparse the entire file.
I don't know if they go that far, but certainly they're doing more analysis of it afterwards. Mm-hmm. And that's the general use of being able to have these ASTs from the compilation phase after the fact. That was one of the reasons why Xcode felt like it was not making a whole lot of progress when they were using GCC. I think, I'm not sure if I mentioned this exactly before, but from what I understand from GCC, the ASTs there, GCC was not broken up in the same way and not able to be used the same way because their ASTs were not as reusable as the Clang ones. Clang was really written to be able to use the ASTs everywhere. GCC was not able to do that. You also weren't able to link it in because it was GNU. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't take advantage of all of these extra things the way that you can now. So, and this is also one reason why Objective-C++ is hard. Because I was just telling you that the logic is very simple. It's very straightforward. When you say, well, we're going to only refactor Objective-C, for example, but we're going to let you put a .mm file, you can't just say, well, we'll just ignore all the C++. Because the C++ could be in the middle of your Objective-C. It could be modifying things in a way that you have to understand to get the code right. You can't just ignore it.
Right.
And so that's, you know, that's hard. It's hard to do. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons you'll know, I can't be sure of this, but one of the reasons you'll know that they've switched to Clang for refactoring is because they'll support Objective-C++. I bet that'll be a good sign for that. Mm-hmm. If I'm right, if I'm guessing correctly. The last thing I wanted to talk about was testing. Now, both Fowler and Apple's documentation mention in regards to refactoring that what you should do is have tests for all your code, then refactor, then run your tests. Mm-hmm. And that's a great theory, right? But yeah, most people don't have 100% test coverage for all of their code, especially like UI code. It's generally really difficult to be able to add, you know, unit tests for view controllers, for example. For legacy code, what do you do? Now, I've mentioned this before. I'm going to mention it again. The working effectively with legacy code, I believe that's what it's called, by Michael Feathers. I really recommend this book. I actually haven't finished it, unfortunately, but I do have it on my shelf. And what I did read of it, I really liked. Because what he talks about is, well, you know, if you have a legacy code base that doesn't have any tests in it at all, here's how you can chip away at that and add tests sort of in slow, small pieces so that you make you add the least amount of risk to the code, but you still gradually pull out stuff and add tests to it. And I think one reason that I stopped reading it was because, again, I think that only works to a certain extent, and then you get to, you know, UI code or other code that's, you just can't put under tests. And so it's good for certain things, but not, you know, it's not a cure-all. Now, I was just talking about how to make an automated system for refactoring. I think another way to think of it is just, well, relying on the automated tools is probably better than doing it by hand if you can, just because they've had more tests, more testing, more bugs written about them. So even if you don't have tests, I think relying on the automated tools is probably better than doing it by hand. But I also think more static typing helps quite a bit. And again, I think this, I talked about it before, the compiler folks really love more static typing because it lets them analyze things better. And the last bit about that I want to mention is to talk about functional programming a tiny bit. And the one piece of functional programming, not the only piece, but one of the pieces of it, is again this very heavy emphasis on static types, on complex static types, such that you can always know that there won't be invalid data coming into your function from the outside, because you can do so much more static analysis of what's going on. Everything is very heavily typed. You know, you can't send something invalid through. You can get the logic wrong, but at least you can know that the inputs are never going to be wrong. And one of the ways that I heard about this, was in a talk by Alexis Gallagher at NS Meetup in this month in San Francisco. And mm-hmm. I'll put a link to the show notes. He did a talk about Swift functional programming and the future of Objective-C. And it was really just a tiny piece of it where he talked about what functional programming is. But he said, sometimes functional programming languages include type systems to provide compile time checks on values moving through the functions, which is something that I think a lot of the Clang static analyzer is trying to do as well. But again, it's kind of stymied by the language. And I think a lot of this more heavy typing in Swift is they're attempting to get closer to that, to being able to do more with the static analysis. And I think, you know, we'll see how they do that. You know, I think they're taking a lot of things out of Swift that were in Objective-C. I think, like, a certain amount of introspection is gone.
Yeah, the dynamicism. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can't just send a method to anything you want. And again, you might say, well, we really need that for the way we like to write programs. And that, you know, that's true. That might be really important to you. But it does also mean that it makes this sort of analysis easier on their side. And I think that's probably why they're trying to go for it. At which point I should probably mention, or maybe I shouldn't mention, that I do have that Haskell book that I have not read very far into, that I should probably get back to at some point. But that's really a little scattered there at the end, but that's what I have to say.
Okay. You said you want to move back around to the Martin Fowler book, Refactoring How Elites Need Gold.
Oh, yeah.
I pretty much put this on myself. I think it's my issue, personally, that I think I've just been programming too long. And
okay.
And it's one of these things where it's actually kind of freaky, because I'll have a Xcode window open. I'll be, writing code. I'll be doing these transformations or whatever. And it will be that, like, consciously, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. It's like, it's just flying out of my fingers. And I'm a big fan of naming things. And I think Fowler actually going through and naming every little bloody transformation is really a good thing. But man, it just feels almost, I guess I kind of feel like a pedantic feeling from it. Like, yeah, of course you can do this stuff. And I think I've been at it too long. And it's one of these things it's like driving for me. It's like, I've done it so much and so excessively that it's just been pushed into my subconscious. And like bringing it up to my conscious level almost feels like an insult to me.
Yeah, the thing that occurs to me now when you were talking about this is I tend to say you want the least amount of structure you can have in most of your endeavors, because structure decays.
Ooh.
And if you make a more elaborate structure, than you need, mm-hmm. then you will have the penalties of it decaying on you and not matching what you need mm-hmm. that you didn't need to go through if you mm-hmm. didn't need that structure to begin with. And I don't know if mm-hmm. that's going to be all that understandable to people, but that's a very, very general purpose way of describing that. But you could apply that here, where you say, if you try to categorize every single last transformation you might ever do, then that's just extra structure that might get in your way. Like, for example, he's got rename method, right? Mm-hmm. And so he said, well, that's what it is. That's the transformation. But it's not. right? Because you're not just renaming methods, you're naming classes, you're naming all these other things. And so his categorization, which he's had in his book and his website for years and years and years, is wrong. It's imprecise. It doesn't match your real world experience. And that's, you know, that's not a, really a problem because you just, oh, okay, I'll just modify that in my head. But if somebody were to say, well, here are the rules, here's the transformations you can have, and you have to use these, well, then that doesn't match what you actually use. And so that might be part of, I think, what you're thinking about is because he tried to categorize everything, now he's made this into structure that's now not quite matching what we need. And that, you know, that's a bit of a cognitive dissonance going on there.
I think your philosophical objections are a bit higher level than my this has been I've been programming too long, but but yes, I actually agree. I really like your take on that. It's good. The other thing that came to my mind is transformations against non-clean code.
Yes,
I am actually really impressed with Xcode. When I have a syntax error or compiler, even a full scale compiler error, that is able. I'm not even like in projects where I'm not even like treating warnings as errors type stuff. That I'm surprised of that it's able to get things right. Oh, during the like I said, the only thing I use of all of the refactoring goodies you led the charge on is renaming stuff. But I'm impressed that renaming has never blown up on me. And so considering that I know what you have to go through to get to you, especially when you're not using Clang underneath, that is bloody impressive. So you should definitely take a bow for that one.
Well, and it's true that there's a reason for that, right? Because again, if you look at the AST nodes, as long as you have any sort of AST node to what's going on in the code, you can make those changes with a fair degree of accuracy that you're figuring it out, right? Because it's not one thing relying on another thing, relying on another thing in a certain order to make it figure out. Again, extract is much more complicated in that regard. But renaming is just finding the pieces. If you can find the pieces, if the AST can be built for that particular section of the code, then you're good. It's when it can't figure those things out anymore. So I'm actually surprised if you... I would be interested in how many times you've refactored something where there was a big error in your code that made Xcode unable to figure out what to do after that, even unable to know where the end of the method was anymore, mismatched braces, that sort of thing. It really shouldn't be able to trigger the ASTs and make them properly at that point for the rest of the method. If it could change instances, references to things after that crazy error, I mean, that really shouldn't work.
Right.
So if it does, it's probably more accident than on purpose. But
well, you know, keep in mind this is mostly me writing code, so my errors don't tend to be too big. That might sound a little bit egotistical, but it's
sure.
So typically, what the things I run into, the errors aren't that major. So and it's been working pretty much to my knowledge, to my memory, it's been worked flawlessly. So so the errors weren't major, but yeah. The final thing that I want to mention is that of course, app code you mentioned briefly. First time you used refactoring in a real IDE was Eclipse, and app code takes it to definitely the next level. It has support for extensive refactorings, and I don't know what type of magic they do behind the scenes to support all this type of stuff. I know it's based on their IntelliJ type stuff.
Yes.
And I would recommend to the audience that if you mentioned yourself that Xcode has kind of the subset that's so well maintained and obviously didn't support for Swift at all. I know that the app code guys actually are starting to support Swift already. I don't even know how they're doing that. Yeah, I don't even know what the extensive the refactoring support is on that. Like that seems to me like totally like craziness. But you know, more power to them. I mean, this is their job.
Yeah.
And I was at the Cocoa Heads in Colorado Springs, and Daniel Hall gave a great presentation on app codes refactoring support. It really made me take a deeper look into it. And while I still don't use app code day to day, it definitely gave me a respect for the kind of the deep code analysis you can do and the type of transformations that you can pull off. And so I would recommend to the audience that if you actually are interested in refactoring, that download app code and give it a whirl, and I think you'll be impressed with that. It's kind of like this is getting me and my personal failings that I don't like for some reason, I have this issue with naming everything that Fowler does, but they do name a heck of a lot of refactorings there. And I think it's almost worth just like you going through every single menu item and kind of like giving a name to the type of transformation, common transformations that programmers perform on code. And I think it's powerful to give names to things. And yeah, this really can help you kind of, when you talk to other programmers and kind of even your own head kind of think through what you're doing, it will be, it can be very helpful.
Sure. Do you have a link to like the slides from that presentation about app code refactoring?
I actually brought it up on meetup.com. I don't know if the slides were ever posted, but I can see if I can dig them up for the show notes.
All right, cool. And we'll
mention, it was a lot of live demo type stuff. So I don't know how good the slides will be, unfortunately.
No, that's a good point. Although you can just go to app code website.
Yeah, good point.
Do this thing. I mean, I think one reason why their refactoring is probably pretty strong is because they had to write a different parser for Objective C and presumably for Swift if they're doing Objective Swift already. But they could probably reuse a lot of their OO refactoring logic from their Java engine for this. Mm-hmm. I mean, not all of it, but it's better than having to write the whole thing from scratch. So I think that's probably one reason why AppCode is as good as it is, has as many features as it does, is because they didn't start from scratch. And they had a lot of building blocks of it already. And so that lets them, you know, start faster to get a lot of these refactorings in because they already basically had the logic for Java.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great thing. That was a really smart move for them to move over into UIKit, AppKit land to do this stuff because nobody else. It's a lot of work to build an IDE, so and you know you just can't do it from scratch when you have such a small market for people who are willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really how they got away with it. Another thing with Eclipse, does expose its ASTs to third-party plugins, as far mm-hmm. as I know. And right. That's one reason. So, for example, I don't remember. Oh, I should have looked it up. There was that thing that you showed in one of your episodes about a different way of writing code that used an Eclipse plugin that in little tiny little snippets of code. Can you remember what that was called now?
Don't remember off the top of my head.
And, you know, that they could do that because they had all this information.
Oh, you're talking about the code bubble stuff?
Code bubble stuff, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll put a link to that.
I don't think that was Eclipse plugin so much. It might use Eclipse in the back end, but yeah.
Oh, I thought that basically you were using Eclipse for it.
They might use the Eclipse infrastructure, but yeah. I think it was kind of its own thing.
Its own thing. Right. It still used that information in the background. They weren't writing their own mm-hmm. ASC parser. They were using that infrastructure.
Right.
I think that's why I've seen a lot of code experiments written in Eclipse, and I think that's why. Because it's just so easy to extend stuff there in a way that you can't, for example, with Xcode, because they don't expose their ASTs to you. And of course, there's no plugin architecture either. So,
mm-hmm.
Alrighty. So if that's it for you.
Yeah, I think this actually might be our longest episode to date. So way to go, man.
All right. We'll see you next time.